Flu season is upon us. The strain of flu going around this year seems to be particularly nasty. Hope it didn't catch you. So what's the difference about this year's sicknesses? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today we'll discuss how the flu is impacting Iowans with state epidemiologist Dr. Patricia Quinlisk. Dr. Patricia Winokur will explain what goes into making the flu vaccine. Pediatrician Dr. Jody Murph will tell us how to prevent and treat the flu among children. And emerging infectious disease specialist Tara Smith will tell us how certain diseases jump from animals to humans. Everything you ever wanted to know about viruses that make us feel awful after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Cold and flu season is upon us, and the strain of flu going around this year is one of the worst Iowa has seen in recent memory. I hope it hasn't caught you. If it has, I hope you're on the mend. Flu is one of those things that every one of us have experienced in our lifetime. We have an awful memory, perhaps many awful memories of coming down with the flu. So this hour, as we learn about viruses, about why this flu season is particularly nasty and different, we want to have you chip in by completing this sentence with your colorful description. Here's a sentence. My worst case of flu made me feel like fill in the blank, something creative. Something we can say on the air would be good, too. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. If you'd like to fill in that blank with by sending us an email. My worst case of flu made me feel like fill in the blank. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us with your answer as well. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Later in the hour, emerging infectious disease specialist Tara Smith of the University of Iowa will tell us how certain diseases jump from animals to humans. But first, let's stick with us. Stick with the humans and this year's bugs. In our Des Moines studio, state epidemiologist Dr. Patricia Quinlisk is with us, also the medical director for the Iowa Department of Public Health. Dr. Quinlisk, welcome back to our program.
Thank you for having me.
So I understand that the flu is now widespread in all but three states as our nation grapples with an earlier than normal season. How would you characterize this year's flu season so far in Iowa in relation to the rest of the country?
Well, we're sort of seeing the flu the same way the rest of the country is. There's high levels of flu going around, and it's throughout our state as it is almost the whole country. And when people are getting sick with the flu, they're getting more seriously sick this year than we have for about a decade.
Mm. And we measure that severity of a sickness by hospitalization. Is that one way?
That certainly is one way. We also, unfortunately, sometimes measure it with deaths because, unfortunately, influenza and its complication pneumonia is still in the top 10 causes of death here in Iowa.
Have we had any deaths in Iowa this year?
Well, we haven't had any that we've been told about, but usually that's somewhat delayed and we don't find out about them right away.
Mm-hmm. Do we know how many people have been hospitalized this year in Iowa compared to last year?
Well, what we do here in Iowa is we ask about 21 of our hospitals to sort of let us know what's happening just at those hospitals. The other ones, we don't ask them to tell us, and it's called a sentinel system. But the bottom line is it allows us to compare 1 week to the next. And, for example, 3 weeks ago we had 68 people hospitalized in those 21 hospitals. A week ago we were at 151, and then last week we went down slightly to 141. So that gives us an idea that, you know, basically we're having a lot of people hospitalized, and the numbers are indeed going up, which then bodes poorly for the rest of those hospitals, too.
Mm-hmm. So we had a dip. Was that reflected also in this CDC numbers? A bit of good news, a slight decline?
Well, it was a slight decline, but I'll just tell you that we know that the reporting is not as good as we'd like it to be over the holidays just because, you know, for example, schools aren't open, so it's hard for us to keep track of the number of children who are not going to school. So we're all sort of holding our breath to see what happens this week after we've had one full week of a normal week with no holidays and what comes out of this reporting week.
Mm-hmm. Holidays. Why are there outbreaks after holidays?
Well, often what happens, of course, is people travel. They get on airplanes or buses or whatever, so they're around a lot more people. Also, people have lots of parties and get-togethers where people are exposed to more people, and people might be a little bit more likely to say, well, this is, you know, Christmas. I'm going to go anyway, even though I don't feel well. And so we just have more exposure to people who might have the flu. And then we come home and we get the flu, and then we start spreading around to our family and friends.
Mm-hmm. Back to getting hospitalized. You named 150-some this past week in those 20-some hospitals in Iowa. How serious do symptoms have to be admitted to a hospital for the flu?
Well, most people with the flu, of course, don't get hospitalized. Most people may be in bed for a week or so, but they don't need to be hospitalized. But we have people in our population who might have other kind of medical conditions, which makes flu more dangerous, or they might be very young or very old and have a hard time, for example, keeping their fluids up or eating enough flu food, and so they end up being hospitalized for that. But, of course, we have a lot of people who get hospitalized just because they're so sick they need to be in a hospital.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, a hospital stay is certainly more expensive than staying at home to get over. So I suppose you have the cost of a hospital stay weighing on people's minds, especially the uninsured.
Well, I'm sure that's of concern. But, you know, if somebody needs to be hospitalized, we certainly want them to go and get admitted to a hospital so that they can be taken care of correctly.
Okay. Also joining us today as we talk about this year's flu viruses, Dr. Jody Murph is with us in our Iowa City studio, associate professor for the Division of General Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine at the University of Iowa. Dr. Murph practices at the Iowa Children's Hospital in Iowa City and Coralville also, I believe. Dr. Murph, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, children get the flu more often than adults, as I understand. Why would that be?
Well, there are several reasons. One, they have immature immune systems, so they may not have been exposed to enough different viruses. They don't have the antibodies to protect them from infection, and they tend to congregate in groups. So they're in school, they're in daycare, they're in preschool, they're in playgroups, they're at the library, they're at the park. And children, if you put them in a room, they congregate together.
They touch each other. They put their fingers everywhere.
They do. They do.
Makes them delightful, but also great for transferring viruses, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
All right.
They're very efficient in transferring viruses.
Well, are there particular ages among children that are higher risk than others?
Children under the age of 5, in general, are higher risk for complications of influenza than older children, but the highest risk is those under the age of 2. So the very youngest are the ones that are more likely to be hospitalized, more likely to have severe disease.
Mm-hmm. What is it about a 2-year-old's body that makes it particularly high risk?
Well, part of it is they're smaller, their lung volume is smaller, it takes less for them to have some compromise. They're more likely to wheeze with respiratory illnesses. If their breathing is impaired, they're less likely to be able to take in sufficient fluids. So there are many, many reasons.
Mm-hmm. So warning signs, red flags that you see among children that a parent should get that child looked at, that they're not going to be able to weather it perhaps at home or they need an extra doctor visit is?
Well, those children who look like they're working harder to breathe, the children who are breathing fast, who may be retracting or sucking in the skin between their ribs, children who are breathing fast and are unable to take in fluids. And if the parent is just worried, they should call their healthcare provider.
Okay. And that age-old question of how you tell the difference between cold symptoms and flu symptoms. Is there an easy way to remember that?
Well, children with the flu, it often occurs much more rapidly, and they get much sicker much more quickly. So they're much more likely to have high fever, to be much more irritable. Then it progresses, and it lasts for longer. Mm-hmm. So in general, it's fairly straightforward for some people to tell the difference. But we also have children who present atypically. So mm-hmm. they may have little fever and just the severe muscle soreness that comes with influenza B.
But typically for the flu, the onset is very quick.
Yes, it is.
Okay. So if you're trying to make that decision whether you have someone stay home from school, whether you yourself go to work, if you're asking that question, if you're on a borderline, then maybe you don't have the flu?
If you have fever and sore throat or other respiratory symptoms, stay home.
Stay home. Okay. And then whatever it is, even if it's a cold, you should be staying home to do that. 1-866-780-9100. Your questions also this hour about this year's flu and viruses in general. Dr. Jody Murph is with us, associate professor for the Division of General Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine at the University of Iowa. Also, our state epidemiologist, Dr. Patricia Quinlisk, medical director for the Iowa Department of Public Health in our Des Moines studio. Adding to our we have a triumvirate of doctors. Dr. Patricia Winokur is with us, Associate Dean for Clinical and Translational Science and also Professor of Internal Medicine at the University of Iowa's Carver College of Medicine, joining us by phone. Dr. Winokur, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder if you could tell us, because many of us, I have, many listening, I'm sure you have, got vaccinated this year. How do scientists select which flu virus goes into each year's vaccine? And you specialize in testing vaccines, do you not?
We do actually quite a number of influenza vaccine studies here at the University of Iowa. And the process for selecting the flu vaccine each year is a little bit tricky. We're trying to look in the crystal ball and figure out how the flu virus is going to change and mutate and select the right strains almost a year before we see that next season's flu strains arising. So we have experts that watch the whole influenza epidemic evolve during the year and then try and predict what they think will be selected for and crop up the next year. So it is not a perfect science. This year they did an excellent job and they did select the correct strains for the vaccine, but it has been a very tough flu year. And even people who are vaccinated, it is not a perfect vaccine. It's a good vaccine, but not perfect.
So if it's a good vaccine, why did we get the early flu season and so severe?
So we know every year that there are quite a number of people who do not get the flu vaccine, and that contributes to a bad flu year. We also know that there are certain years where the vaccine doesn't match the strains that are circulating very well. That does not appear to be the case this year. And then we know that the flu vaccine works about 70% of the time, even in the best of circumstances. So if you have a lot of flu circulating because it's a bad year, even people who are vaccinated can come down with the disease. Usually it's less severe, though.
Dr. Quinlisk, tell us, how many Iowans got vaccinated this year? Do you know that number?
Well, we don't quite know for this year because, of course, people are still getting vaccinated. But we know from previous years that actually Iowa does very well compared to the rest of the country in getting people vaccinated. Unfortunately, very well doesn't mean that we don't have a ways to go. We still have a lot of people in our populations that don't get vaccinated. Usually the elderly are the ones that get the best rates of vaccination. We're doing better and better with children, though we have a ways to go. And another group is our pregnant women, and that group, unfortunately, is not nearly as well vaccinated as we would like.
When we compare states, you say Iowa is doing very well. Could you, or perhaps this ranking exists among states that have higher vaccination rates than others?
Yeah, actually, there are ratings that do come out. And for example, in the elderly, I believe we're number one in the country for children, I think we're somewhere around in the upper 10. But again, pregnant women were down farther. So there, again, we're doing very well when compared to the rest of the country, but we still, even in the elderly, we still have quite a few elderly that don't get vaccinated. And unfortunately, then that puts them at higher risk of getting the flu and getting hospitalized or even dying with the flu.
Dr. Jody Murph, you're our pediatrician. When or should you vaccinate children?
We vaccinate as soon as we get the vaccine from the state. And so that's usually the last of August, first of September. Mm-hmm. So all of those children who come in fairly frequently in the first 2 years of life, we try to administer the vaccine when they come in for a well check. For those who may not be due for a well check in that early fall window, we try to make sure that we educate them throughout the year so that they know that if school is ready to start, it's time to get your flu shot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that starts on, is there any risk to vaccination depending on the age of the child?
Is there a risk to vaccination?
Yes, sure, especially with children.
Everyone who takes acetaminophen or ibuprofen or gets a vaccine incurs a small risk. It's usually a sore arm, maybe a little low-grade fever. So vaccine side effects are in general very mild. Severe reactions like anaphylaxis or a severe allergic reaction are very uncommon. It's about one in every 1 million doses, so just about like your chance of getting struck by lightning.
Okay. Dr. Patricia Winokur, you test vaccines. Why doesn't that last more than a year?
So that's a very good question. And one of the things we know is the human body does not make a very strong immune response to the flu proteins. Usually other diseases, measles, mumps, you get one vaccine and it lasts almost for a lifetime.
Exactly. Yeah. What is the difference then?
It's probably, there are a couple reasons. The flu virus is able to change itself quite readily. And so every year we're dealing with different strains. So even if you've developed a nice response to the flu viruses that are circulating this year, that virus may be different enough next year that the antibodies you made don't match. So that's part of the problem, and part of it is simply the flu proteins don't induce the longest and best immune response in a human compared to other proteins, and we don't 100% know why that is.
Okay, so that's an area of research that we may see advances in the future.
There are quite a number of studies that are going on trying to develop what we call a universal flu vaccine, which is one that would be better. You give it 1 year, and it's good for all the strains that come up over a lifetime. That's certainly a goal.
Mm-hmm.
We're very early in those studies.
Can you imagine such a vaccine?
I think there's starting to be some progress in developing that kind of vaccine. Whether it'll come to fruition, I don't know, but there are some promising leads. The other thing that we're doing is we're trying to develop different ways of vaccinating people. So there are studies that are ongoing now, some that we're participating at the University of Iowa, using DNA vaccines. These are vaccines that they don't in and of themselves protect, but they often stimulate the immune response in a slightly different way. And then when you boost someone with a regular flu vaccine, it seems like the protection is a little bit better and a little bit broader, so that you don't have to be quite so perfect in targeting the flu strain each year. So that's a possibility. And there are many other ways that we're developing vaccines.
One of our listeners from Davenport, Kelly, writes, I've heard that the flu mist is effective for a whole year, where a regular flu shot only protects for a handful of months. Is that true? Should more people try to get flu mist instead of the shot? Dr. Winokur, can I hand that to you?
Yes. So children under the age of 8 respond much better to flu mist than they do to the regular shot in the arm type of vaccine. Adults, unfortunately, the response has not been quite as good. So we're seeing differences between age groups. And so I would recommend the kids, absolutely, the flu mist is very, very effective. In adults, it's effective, but there may be a slight advantage to the regular shot in the arm type of vaccine.
And I see you, Dr. Murph, agreeing with that assessment as a pediatrician. One thing we want to mention, too, that people deal with when flu is the Tamiflu. What is Tamiflu? Remind us of that. And how is that different than getting vaccinated? Yes, Dr. Murph.
Tamiflu is an antiviral, and so for someone who is in a high-risk group and is exposed to a known case of influenza, it may prevent them from getting the flu and then prevent them from getting very ill. For someone in a high-risk group who has flu, you can also treat them so that you can moderate their symptoms so that they may not progress.
So when you say an antiviral, it's mm-hmm. working different than a vaccine in what way?
It works differently in that it is it doesn't produce antibodies. It simply targets the virus so that, and I think Dr. Winokur could probably speak to this better than I, but it's designed to be given to prevent in the short term, not in the long term, mm-hmm. so after an exposure, whereas the vaccine is intended to produce antibodies to protect you throughout that whole influenza season.
Dr. Winokur, did you have anything to add to that on Tamiflu?
So I think for the listeners, Tamiflu is equivalent to an antibiotic. So similarly to the pneumonia vaccine. The pneumonia vaccine protects you from getting the disease, but once you get the disease, you need an antibiotic to kill that bacteria. Tamiflu is a product that actually kills the virus in the human body. So once you get it, it works to try and kill it. It doesn't work great. It probably reduces symptoms for maybe you get better faster by about 24 hours. And then, as Dr. Murph stated, we can, in the short term, use Tamiflu to prevent spread of illness in a nursing home or close quarters where the flu is spreading rampantly in high-risk populations.
So unlike a vaccine, Tamiflu is the acting agent. We're not encouraging the body to attack the virus. We have an agent attacking it.
Right. We're using the drug to do that.
Okay, good. Randy is with us from Iowa County. Randy, we're coming up on a break, but I think you have a quick question.
Somebody was telling me yesterday that the hospital in Pawshee County said that even if you're going to be using hand sanitizers, some of these germs are immune to it.
Mm. Okay, hand sanitizer. Dr. Quinlisk, could you handle that one?
Sure. Well, first of all, we do recommend that people use soap and water and wash their hands for as long as it takes them to sing Happy Birthday twice as the best way of getting your hands clean. But sometimes you don't have that around, and certainly hand sanitizers are a good thing to use. They're relatively well effective against the traditional influenza virus, but there's another virus going around Iowa right now called the norovirus, which causes people to get diarrhea and vomiting, and we have found that that virus is not well attacked by the gel. So in that case, probably the gels don't do as good a job as we'd like, and you really need to be washing your hands for that norovirus. But for the flu, it probably works pretty well.
Before we have to go, Dr. Winokur, I understand you test vaccines. That's what you specialize in. And what are you working on right now, if you could tell us about that in a minute or so?
So we actually have a new study that just started today, and we're giving our first vaccinations today. And we're looking at a new vaccine that targets the H3N2 variant strain of influenza. And this is a strain that perhaps your readers heard about or your listeners heard about this summer, when it was a strain of influenza that came very early in the summertime, not our typical wintertime, and we were seeing people who were in county fairs that had a lot of close contact with pigs coming down with this influenza strain. And it is a strain that does seem to have circulated in the pig population and then has switched over into affecting small numbers of humans. It doesn't pass from human to human very well right now, but we always watch these viruses that come from animals and into humans very carefully because they can mutate and become the next pandemic strain of influenza. So we are evaluating new vaccines designed to target this variant strain to try and understand what we would need to do to protect people should that become a much more important strain in our population.
So the strain you just mentioned, H3N2, we hope we don't hear too much about that H3N2, hopefully,
well,
correct?
H3N2 variant, because right now we do have H3N2 circulating in the population, but it's our usual human strain of influenza.
Well, thank you all for making this very complicated area of viruses accessible to us. Dr. Patricia Winokur.
Thank you.
And Dr. Jody Murph and Dr. Patricia Quinlisk. We appreciate you coming on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll talk with an emerging infectious disease specialist, Tara Smith of the University of Iowa. Pick up where we're leaving off. She'll tell us how certain diseases jump from animals to humans when we return. Everything you wanted to know about those viruses that make us feel awful. Back in just a few minutes with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River over the noon hour here on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we're talking about viruses, the ones that make us feel crummy. Flu now widespread in all but three states in the country, grappling with an earlier than normal season, flu season. Talking about some of the science behind the viruses that make us feel crummy. And this half hour, we want to talk about how certain diseases jump from animals to humans. We heard in the last part of the half hour our first half hour, how that is a particular area of interest for people who study this. Tara Smith is with us now in our Iowa City studio. She's an associate professor for the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Iowa, also co-director of the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases, and a blogger for scienceblogs.com, where she writes about infectious diseases. Tara Smith, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
You wrote an online article for Slate Online last month on how diseases transfer from animals to humans. And you cite one case that you pick up in that article that occurred in Hong Kong, where six people died from an outbreak of a strain called H5N1. Tell us what we know about the origins of that strain, why it's interesting.
Sure. So that strain comes originally from birds, and it's carried by wild waterfowl, apparently throughout parts of Asia, Europe, and Africa, and it's sporadically jumped into humans. So there have been about 600 to 700 cases of that worldwide that we've seen over the past 6 or 7 years. What's interesting about that is that typical flu, it infects a lot of people, but it does not have a very high mortality rate. But H5N1, of those 600 to 700 people that have been infected, about half of them have died. So it is a very, very high mortality rate for a flu virus. So that's why we've been really tracking this for the last several years.
What is it about a strain that makes it particularly dangerous? Why was H5N1 such a dangerous strain? What is it doing in the body differently than other less dangerous strains?
Mm-hmm. That's kind of the million-dollar question. We don't really know all of the factors that cause it to be kind of hypervirulent like this one seems to be. One hypothesis is that it actually causes the human body to respond kind of at a higher level, so that actually it's kind of the host response that is causing the host to actually die, rather than, you know, with some of the more mild influenza viruses, that doesn't seem to happen.
Mm-hmm. Do we know what causes a strain to jump from animals to humans? You used the word sporadic a few minutes ago. Are we to equate that with a random mutation that all of a sudden it's like going to Las Vegas and you pull the arm and all of a sudden you've got three lemons or something like that?
Kind of. These types of events are probably happening really frequently.
Mm-hmm.
But in most cases, when they jump from, you know, animals to people, they probably don't cause us to get sick, or if so, to only get mildly sick. So they wouldn't ever appear on the radar of people in, you know, medicine or public health. With H5N1, it seems to cause illness most of the time. We haven't been able to find people, or at least not very many, who have evidence that they've been infected before, but they haven't gotten sick. So it happens pretty frequently. Just in most cases, we probably don't catch it. And then we, you know, really don't notice it until you have some kind of an outbreak like this in a kind of a geographically isolated area where you see lots of cases in a short period of time.
So are you saying that there are strains out there that have jumped to humans that we don't even know about because they're not causing many problems or very few problems?
Right, sure. There's been some research from people here at the University of Iowa looking at swine flu viruses, like was just mentioned in the past half hour, that people working with swine are much more likely to have been infected with these viruses, but you'd never know it. You wouldn't know that it was different from, you know, the typical human yearly influenza. You wouldn't necessarily know unless you get it tested by an academic lab or something that it actually came from pigs rather than, you know, your neighbor down the street.
Mm-hmm. You just talked about this one strain, H5N1. Of course, the one we've heard in our news for several years is H1N1,
mm-hmm.
A recent global pandemic, particularly difficult to treat. Remind us about the characteristics of that strain.
So H1N1 was also this new kind of swine variant was also from pig origin, seemed to originate in Mexico. At least that's where they first saw the initial cases. And it was a reassortant. So that virus is kind of a mess. It has actually genes from pig origin and also from bird origin. So it's kind of a triple reassortant, they call it, because it has human, bird, and pig genes.
Mm-hmm. Why is it difficult to treat?
Not sure about that. I'm
okay, that's
not a clinician. That's not my area.
Okay. But this is not, when we talk about strains going from animals to humans. This is nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
I'm recalling several years ago reading that book about from Jared Diamond,
mm-hmm.
About why, for instance, Native Americans were more susceptible to diseases than the European settlers coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something that's been going on. Is there something new in our era that has accelerated it because we're jet-setting all around the world?
Mm-hmm. There are a few things. One is, you know, the increased speed of world travel. You can be around the world right now in 24 hours, where, of course, you know, even a century ago, it took days, weeks, months. So that's one thing, is that people can spread these viruses from, you know, China to the U.S. in just a matter of a day. Another is that we have increased detection for these. We have much better resources that we can tell, you know, if it is a pig virus or a bird virus rather than a human virus. So we can, you know, do that in the lab in a matter of days now, whereas previously it took, you know, a lot of time and effort and materials. Another is that we are encroaching on wildlife habitats. There is a lot of wildlife habitat destruction across the world, and that's bringing us into increased contact with animals that maybe, you know, we hadn't been in contact with before. A lot of the bats and other, you know, rodents, other type of wildlife that can harbor these viruses and then can spread them to humans.
In reading your article, you write about how bats are notorious for transferring mm-hmm. diseases to humans. I'm sad to hear that because bats are one of my favorite animals.
I love bats. I don't want to, you know, don't want people to not like them because of that. But
so why mm-hmm. do they spread these diseases? Why are they particularly good at it?
Uh-huh. We're not 100% sure. Bats seem to have kind of a different immune system than humans, and there hasn't been a lot of research into that, but they just seem to be able to harbor these, you know, this wide diversity of viruses, typically that don't cause disease in the bats, but that they can spread to other species, including humans.
Hmm.
Also, there's just great diversity amongst bats. There are about 6,000 or so species of mammals, and about 1,200 of those are bats. So if you figure that, you know, each species carries a few unique viruses, then just by a numbers game, you would expect a lot of those to come from bat species.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the idea that initially brings to mind for me that bats like darkness
mm-hmm.
and viruses don't like sunlight?
No, kind of. That could play a role. I mean, also some bats are migratory as well, so that yeah. can, you know, spread their viruses over a larger range than, you know, rodents or something that are pretty limited in their range.
What about animals that we come into more frequent contact than bats? A dog or a cat?
Mm-hmm.
Should we be worried about catching anything from our dogs and cats?
I don't know about worried, but there is the potential. Certainly, cats, for example, can carry a parasite called toxoplasma. So this is why, like, pregnant women are advised not to change litter boxes and things like that, because they can come into contact with this, which can cause pretty severe effects if it is transmitted to the unborn baby.
Mm-hmm.
Dogs, you can share lots of different infections with them as well. Even there were some cases of, going back to the H1N1, of people sharing that virus with their dogs. So in some cases, dogs have more to fear from us than we do
We can get them back. We can,
mm-hmm,
we
absolutely.
So actually, when they greet us at the door, when we come home during the day with that big slobbery kiss, we don't know what might happen.
Right. Yeah, it's a bi-directional transfer, so that, you know, we can give stuff to them and they can give stuff to us.
So birds, another animal that we might be worried about.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
Same thing with bats, is that, you know, many of them can migrate, so they can spread these long distances. I mentioned at the beginning that wild waterfowl were reservoirs for H5N1, but actually waterfowl are reservoirs for all known influenza viruses. So there's all kinds of viruses out there, influenza subtypes that, you know, ducks, geese, things like that are carrying around and can potentially transmit to humans.
We're talking with Tara Smith this half hour, Associate Professor for the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Iowa, co-director of the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases. And if you have a question or a comment about our topic, which is how certain diseases jump from animals to humans, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's talk about primates, monkeys and apes frequently transferring disease to humans as well.
Yes. And probably the best known example of that is HIV. So this is something that originated in Africa and actually has made a species jump several times. There are two different types of HIV, HIV-1 and HIV-2. HIV-1 is the one that causes most of the issues, and that is thought to have come into the human population from chimpanzees. So probably from people in Africa that actually butcher chimpanzees for meat, come into contact with their blood either by, you know, cuts in their hands or potentially by processing them for eating. And so that's something that appears to have jumped from chimpanzees into humans at least three times on three separate occasions.
We get vaccines for flu viruses, vaccines for all kinds of things. Why has HIV been so difficult to create a vaccine for?
HIV is tough because it's a retrovirus. So it's an RNA virus that can basically get into our genomes. And we're just not sure how to create a good virus or a good vaccine against that. There's been lots of very smart people working on it, and you know, just nothing has really panned out so far.
Mm-hmm. When we go back in history, we know of the Black Plague, one of the most famous pandemics in human history. This also an instance where something jumped from animals to, in this case, what, rats?
Absolutely. So the Black Plague is a bacterial disease caused by a bacteria called Yersinia pestis. And so it can be carried by rats and other rodents. Actually, here in the U.S., it's carried by prairie dogs in the Southwest. But what happened during the Black Plague is that fleas would bite rats who were infected and then bite humans, and they could transfer the bacteria in that manner. And then actually within humans, it could become what's called pneumonic. So it could get into humans' lungs and transmit person to person from there.
Mm-hmm. And at that time, it was not understood how this was transmitted.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. What if the Black Plague, something similar to it, surfaced these days? Would it be stamped out? Would it be reacted to quickly?
Mm-hmm. We do still have cases of plague. There are a handful of cases every year in the U.S., many more in places like India and things like that, where they can still have epidemics of plague. And it is treatable with antibiotics. So usually if it's caught early and diagnosed early, you can completely treat that just like a skin infection or something, just with a dose of antibiotics.
Is it the Hanta virus?
Mm-hmm.
That's also been our news, also from rats?
Yes, from different species of rodents.
How is different? How is that one different, the characteristics of the Hanta virus?
That's a virus, and it's actually, in the rodent, again, it doesn't tend to cause symptoms in the natural host, but they excrete it in their feces and urine. And so what happens is when a house has rodents and, you know, rodent urine dries in places and feces is present, if you go in to clean it and you sweep it with a broom or something, that causes it to be aerosolized and get into the air, then you breathe it in.
Mm-hmm.
And then it becomes a pulmonary syndrome, so that it attacks the lungs, and basically you have a pretty severe pneumonia, and that's what makes you very ill, and in some cases it causes death.
And you might not know where it came from, but it could be, for instance, to give a concrete example, maybe you've got an old shed on your property, and you decide once every 10 years whether it needs it or not, I'm going to clean it out.
Uh-huh.
and there's some rats that have been there. So this could be a case. These are incredibly long-lived. They can live in the feces that long?
Yeah, they can. They seem to be pretty hardy in the environment. So they can live, you know, it can still infect you even after being on a surface for, you know, months to possibly years, especially if it's in the dark and out of kind of sunlight and UV.
Mm-hmm. As we're talking about how these diseases can be transferred from animals to humans, do we have to worry about eating animal food products, getting a virus from eating meat, for instance?
Sure. Most of our foodborne illnesses are largely bacterial that we think of, so salmonellas, E. coli, things like that. But a lot of those do have animal origins. They start out in the animal, again, usually in their fecal material, and do end up transferred onto the meat products during slaughter, and then come home with us from the grocery store. And if we aren't careful about handling them and cooking them, then you can end up with, you know, bacteria or viruses from animals that can make you sick.
And also it goes for eggs, dairy products as well?
Yep, absolutely. Dairy isn't so much of an issue anymore just because of pasteurization, which pretty much kills everything. But there are people right now that there's been an increased demand for raw milk. where it's not pasteurized. And that has led to outbreaks of a couple different diseases, Campylobacter, for instance, in humans.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Tara Smith of the University of Iowa's Department of Epidemiology, also co-director of the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases. Also in your article, I was amused toward the end of it. You had a section asking the question, so why aren't we all dead? We have all these viruses, they're mutating, they're changing. It seems like they're all after us.
Mm-hmm.
What is the answer to that question? Why aren't we all dead if they're after us?
Well, we do have, you know, a pretty good way to keep these in check, and that's our host immune system. So most of the time, like I mentioned, these things are crossing over all the time. We've probably been exposed to many more than we'll ever realize, but they don't cause serious disease in us. Our immune system keeps them in check. They're not suited, you know, maybe haven't evolved to replicate very well in our body, cause symptoms. So we're infected, but we never know.
Mm-hmm. So as an emerging infectious disease specialist, you would be the one to ask whether any of these stories that we see in literature, we read in literature, on TV and film about an apocalypse mm-hmm. caused by some sort of organism, a virus or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Are we at the point now where something could really catch us by surprise? The Andromeda strain, 1969, uh-huh. Michael Crichton, I think.
Uh-huh.
Right.
We are, and things do catch us by surprise, you know, several times a year. You know, SARS was the last kind of one of the first pandemics of the, you know, the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st. And that came out of nowhere. And it spread, you know, all over the world before we even had a handle on what this was. And that came originally from bats. Mm. So, you know, things do come out of nowhere. Our public health system is not really prepared for these, and we lose funding pretty much every year to do surveillance for these.
Mm-hmm. SARS is where now?
SARS was actually pretty much eradicated. Well, not eradicated, but the outbreak was stopped pretty well by using quarantine and kind of isolation methods. So it was one that was really a public health success story because it was stopped in its tracks before it could do much worse damage than it did.
So in the looking into the future, in the threats posed by emerging infectious diseases, what do you see as the biggest threats in our future? Is it this defunding that we actually could be prepared if we would only fund it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's definitely one thing. I mean, we know that as was talked about last half hour, you know, flu is something that is constantly emerging. It's an RNA virus. It's unstable. It's mutating all the time. It's evolving in different hosts. So, you know, there's going to be another pandemic at some point. Luckily, H1N1, as far as pandemic goes, was fairly mild. But will the next one be the same way? You know, we don't know. And we don't have a lot of good resources to track those things before they emerge.
Mm-hmm. If you could decide and have all the resources you needed to mm-hmm. tackle any future emerging infectious disease, mm-hmm. what would it look like worldwide? What would be in place that we don't have today?
Just more surveillance. I mean, even here in the U.S., we do a lot with hospital-based diseases. But, you know, that's after it's kind of already emerged and it's causing illness in humans. So we don't have a lot of good ways to track things that may be jumping that host barrier but not causing a lot of human illness yet. So, you know, more surveillance for things that are not maybe necessarily you know, symptomatic or causing big epidemics, but maybe causing mild illness in a lot of people and evolving along the way.
Just curious, as we finish up here, Tara Smith, are you in any way a fan of apocalypse dramas on TV or in books?
I do. I'm a big fan of kind of post-apocalyptic drama and literature.
Really?
Uh-huh.
And do you do anything other than being a fan in a professional capacity at all?
Yeah, I'm actually a member of the advisory board of the Zombie Research Society.
No.
So I do a lot of reading of kind of zombie literature and watch lots of zombie movies.
So what do you do in that role? Do you try to steer people into more realistic visions of a zombie apocalypse?
Yeah, I've been called on as a consultant for, you know, authors who are putting together novels or movies, things like that, you know, to try to figure out, well, I want to have a virus caused this. So how would I do that? How would it transmit? What's realistic?
Uh-huh. So. Uh-huh. What of course, The Walking Dead, a huge success right now on cable television, very popular. You watch The Walking Dead?
I do.
That has something to do with the virus. The zombies, you don't want to be bitten, right?
Right. Yeah, there's a virus at the root of all of that. Mm-hmm.
Do you find yourself, as an infectious disease specialist, being able to enjoy that genre, or do you say, that couldn't happen?
I try to suspend disbelief. Sometimes, you know, if I'm with my significant other or something, I'll point out some of the inconsistencies or, you know, that wouldn't happen type of things. But I try to just go with it a little bit and turn off the scientist for a little while.
Okay. Very good. Tara Smith, zombies at all a possibility?
maybe the rage zombies, not so much the real ones that come back from the dead.
Okay, very good. We'll leave it there. Tara Smith, co-director of the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases, associate professor for the Department of Epidemiology at the University of Iowa, also a blogger. Find her work about infectious diseases at scienceblogs.com. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Thank you, Tara Smith, for being with us
Thank
today.
You.
It's been fun. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. Technical support we had in Des Moines from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay tuned tomorrow at this time for Politics Wednesday. Join our conversation as we go over the recent political landscape with some analysis. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.